My guest today is Dr. Daniel Holm, founder and CEO of Satalia, which is an award-winning AI company acquired by WPP, the world's largest marketing and advertising company. He's also the chief AI officer at WPP, a faculty member at Singularity University, and a globally recognized thought leader in AI ethics, strategy, and innovation. He spent more than two decades building AI systems, and you'll hear he's not afraid to challenge conventional wisdom. And so today, we're going to be diving into some myth-busting truths about AI, SaaS, and really the future of work. First of all, Daniel, thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be here, Rick. Thanks.
So let's jump right into it, which is really myth one, is that software as a service is dead in the age of AI. I mean, social media is the worst place to get information. There are a lot of people claim that AI will make SaaS obsolete. We won't need products, just prompts. You've kind of said that's completely wrong. Why is that?
Well, it depends on time. I think there's a future where we might have an application that we speak to, and everything that we engage with, whether it be Deliveroo or Uber or or information, gets rendered in the app. Now, I think that I can imagine a future where that could be possible, but I think between now and then, we're going to see an explosion of new innovations, SaaS innovations that are going to be created by people that are using these technologies for vibe coding, new apps, new ideas. So I think between now and a app that does everything, we're going to see an explosion of SaaS.
So really explosion of SaaS, but not necessarily the traditional SaaS you've been seeing. I mean, if you think about a SaaS app, you know, usually, I mean, there are 100 ways to build SaaS apps, but usually you see sort of three layer architectures like databases, business logic, and UI presentation. The UI presentation seems to have been disrupted in some ways if everyone's using voice through their favorite LLM.
Yeah, indeed. I think, you know, voice is an exciting new interface. There obviously are things that people will want to see. So I'm excited about, you know, augmenting the world through glasses and things like that. And, you know, we'll just see how some of these things play out. But certainly LLMs is a new sort of paradigm in technology to change how we interact with the world and information.
Yeah. And so if you're a SaaS founder in the audience and you're trying to think through like adding LLM functionality into your own product versus integrating with the public LLMs, how should you think about your product roadmap in this AI era?
Well, I've actually, you know, I invest in companies now and I've spun out a few companies from WPP. And obviously we use LLMs extensively across WPP. Out of the 100,000 people in WPP, we have over 70,000 people using these technologies in anger. Wow. And so I guess, first of all, it starts out with the problem that you're trying to solve for. And an LLM actually might not be the answer for that problem. It might be a traditional machine learning method, or it might be an optimization method, or it might be a very simple task automation method, a macro, and if then else statement. So we shouldn't necessarily start with data. We shouldn't necessarily start with technology, start with the problem. That said, you know, there are a plethora of different models out there that we can utilize, all the way from, you know, from ChatGPT that we license through to open source models. And again, depending on the nature of the problem, that will determine the model that you're going to go for. Certainly, if you can utilize open source models and deploy them on your own infrastructure, it can be a lot more cost effective than using these models as a service.
Mark Benioff, who's obviously been one of the pioneers of SaaS for decades now, he's recently said that SaaS is where the action is. AI is a commodity because all the models are training on the same data, at least the public ones. Whether you believe they're that or not, are there examples out there that AI amplifies SaaS rather than replacing it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So we in WPP, we built WPP Open. WPP Open is an end-to-end marketing platform. There are broadly seven core problems that you need to solve for in marketing, from performance prediction, which is machine learning, to channel optimization, to identifying dynamic segments, which is, again, machine learning. What was interesting about marketing and LLMs is that when LLMs came along, they unlocked four aspects of our supply chain that historically were left to human beings. Creativity, where you can actually get LLMs to be creative, to come up with creative ideas. Content creation, obviously LLMs are amazing at coming up with content. Audience perception, so testing content against synthetic audiences. And then identifying moments that are going on around the world is a combination between LLMs and machine learning. And so what LLMs have done is they've enabled us to essentially solve end-to-end marketing And that's not only enabled WPP to now sell an enterprise AI software solution, but they've now turned that into a SaaS solution called WPP Open Pro that is now going to be available to the long tail of, you know, companies out there that historically haven't been able to engage with larger advertising agencies. We've taken all of that knowledge, all of that capability, that data, we've managed to package it up into a SaaS solution that's now accessible to the world.
Yeah, I mean, so you mentioned the seven problems that advertising needs solved, how LLMs in particular help with four of them. I'd love to hear the other three because I haven't heard it quite put that way, I think.
Yeah. So again, this is a sort of crude way of thinking about it. Yeah. But this is sort of what I focus on. So one is creativity. We've actually trained a model based on the genius of our creatives. We backtested it against briefs, and it's able to come up with ideas that would have won Cannes Lions. So we know that we can get AIs to come up with ideas that are award-winning. And that's providing our creatives the ability to come up with hundreds of creative, amazingly creative ideas. So creativity. The second one is obviously content generation. We create ads, whether they be text or imagery or video, which is an obvious use case for these models. Audience perception is actually very important. So we call these audience brains. So, you know, if we've got a piece of content, the question is, how do we know how people will perceive this content? We can now build synthetic audiences that allow us to recreate how people think and feel about things. Then this performance prediction. So I need to understand, you know, will this piece of content lead to clicks, likes, sales I expect? There's channel optimization, which is now how do I push that content across all of the different channels to maximize my return? That's an optimization problem. Then there's also dynamic segment identification. You know, a lot of organizations have quite static segments. They think of the world the people that they sell to. Actually, the reality is that these segments are changing all the time. Arguably, AI agents are going to be a new emerging dynamic segment. At some point, you will give agency to your AI, the ability to make purchasing powers, and we need to figure out actually how to sell to AIs and not just to human beings.
Yeah. I mean, that's fascinating to think that we'll have to do that. But ultimately, the year is not far off where that could be a significant portion of commerce. Even small, you know, tens and hundreds of basis points adds up to billions of dollars pretty quickly, which is the exciting part. We've seen how entire ecosystems of data and content and human interaction can change over the decades. You think about, like, we used to go to the store and buy an atlas and then, like, take it in the car with us on the trip. And then it was MapQuest because we didn't have mobile phones. We would, like, print it out at home and then take it in the car with us because there is no compute powerful enough to come with us. Now the car is dynamically rerouting. You know, it tells us where the police is. It tells us where the traffic is. It tells us how to be more efficient, tells us where to stop. The map wasn't killed by mobile or software or even AI, which is now in maps. It just really turbocharged. It just made it tremendously more useful. Is that a decent analogy for how we can think about these sort of like fundamental human problems that aren't going to go away with AI? They're just going to be done completely differently.
Yeah, it's a great analogy. And you know, there's a concept called Jevons Law, which, you know, when you can be done more efficiently, it doesn't go away. You actually sometimes see more of it. And the fact that we can now code with AI means that there's many more coding. The fact that we can create really great marketing campaigns with AI means we're going to see more marketing, more relevant marketing, more effective marketing.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we're going to see some industries just really blossom with these
technologies. Yeah. There's a PhD researcher I'm familiar with called Ruth Cowan, who wrote a book, I think, and even in the 50s, and like it's called More Work for Mother. And it basically meant that, and this is traditional two breadwinner home, and the woman was at home and the man was, this is not reality anymore. But the reality is, like, thought the invention of the vacuum cleaner would mean like, oh, we don't need to do housework anymore. But the reality, what happened is quite the opposite, is now because you can vacuum every day rather than taking, you know, pulling up the rug and taking it outside and beating it with a cane, a switch to get the dust off. Now you are expected to have no dust in your house every time someone came over. And so the work multiplied, in fact, probably 100-fold just because of automation and efficiency. I definitely think your analogy sort of applies here too.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, jobs will be displaced, a bit sort of disrupted, but I think we're going to see a sort of Cambrian explosion of new innovations over the next 5 years. If I'm honest, beyond 5 years, I don't think anybody knows what they're talking about. We can speculate, but yeah. I think it's going to be an exciting 5 years ahead.
I want to move on to our next myth, which is, I think McKinsey has recently written a report talking about how most AI projects failed. And look, most software projects failed. So I'm not really worried about like the debate over that. It's kind of useful, but a lot of people are saying the tech isn't ready, like AI isn't ready. And so if SaaS isn't dead, people still know how to do software. Like, why do AI initiatives fail inside software companies so often right now?
Yeah, I think so. So you made an excellent point there, which is developing and deploying AI is the same as deploying software. And actually, a lot of organizations don't have any pedigree or experience right. in what it means to actually build and scale software yeah. in the organization. Yeah, yeah. It's going to be bound to fail. You don't understand how to test it, to maintain, support, innovate it. And so that's why it stops at the proof of concept. One of the other reasons why it stops at the proof of concept is because the reality is that it's not the technology is not ready, but you should think of these technologies at the moment a little bit like intoxicated graduates. The question is, would you hire an intoxicated graduate to go and do this job? if the answer is no, then it's probably, you know, you probably shouldn't be deploying an AI, or you have to take that intoxicated graduate and you have to make it smarter through context, through teaching it how to become an expert, or even agentifying it, which is, you know, much more complex. But I think we overestimate the capability right now of these technologies. That said, they will get smarter. They're going to go from intoxicated graduate to a master's level to a PhD level postdoc. It's predicted by the end of this decade, we might even have a professor in our pocket.
In some domains, it already feels like we're there with master's and professor level LTZ. In some areas, I totally agree with you. The intoxicated part gets to the hallucination points where sources seem to be invented sometimes out of thin air. There's no reason for that. I think it's improving. And I think sort of the natural sort of check and balances, you'll have multiple models checking each other and then compiling that in result. And so it shouldn't be that hard for AI to check itself before we get to the point of putting it in front of a user.
Exactly. The two exciting things for me, developments that I think need to happen, is one is the ability to do reasoning. So if it can, and also apply some sort of scientific method. So rather than just assuming that the data that it's been trained on is true, rather than just taking that as a truth or an axiom, can they actually then test whether that is true or not, that belief is true? So if I know that Socrates is a man based on my data, and I know that all men are mortal, historically, if I didn't have in my data the ability to Socrates immortal, it wouldn't make that inference. Right. So what we can do is we can start to make inferences, which is great, but we could also start to apply the scientific method and say, is Socrates actually a man? Are men actually all mortal? And so we can test the beliefs of these AIs. So I think that what we'll see over the next several years is these things getting much more smarter, much more robust, because they're not just being statistical, they're actually trying to test their own assumptions.
If you're inside a company, everyone's starting a whole bunch of AT, you know, AI projects. I find that most people are just treating them like another IT project, meaning like, hey, we think this could be helpful, or a CFO, we need to cut costs. They throw the ball over the wall. They treat it like a normal IT project. Not every company is ready to deal with the learning and other implications of an AI project. What are signs that your organization isn't ready, even if your tech team might be ready?
I think there are four red flags for me. We already talked about one of them, which is if you've never built software, you're going to really struggle building AI. The second one is a company that's trying to hire an AI team. Now, the reality is that most organizations can't attract and retain AI talent. There are people that have obviously rebranded themselves as AI experts over the past 3 years. The reality is if you want to build differentiated AI solutions, you need to have differentiated AI talent. And that talent is not easy to attract, retain. And most of AI, I've got 300 deep AI experts within my organization. And they, believe me, it's not easy to hang on to those when DeepMind are offering them five times their salaries. And then the third one is waiting for your data to be ready. Your data is never going to be ready. You know, 10 years later, if I'm having been told to build data lakes, your data is not going to be ready. Start with the problem and then force your data to solve that problem. And finally, and I'm guilty of this, which is, you know, AI is being seen as a way of unlocking productivity. So let's go after quick wins and low hanging fruit. I've said the same thing. The reality is that quick wins and low hanging fruit are not going to differentiate your business and actually build solutions. The reality is that a third party vendor can solve that problem at a fraction of the price. You need to focus on applying AI to solving problems across your supply chain that are going to differentiate yourself from your competitors. And those problems are not quick and they're not easy.
I really love this advice because I think so many people like this low-hanging fruit analogy. It's applied for business for time immemorial. At the end of the day, there's always sort of the 80-20 rule. From an impact point of view and a risk point of view, it's certainly riskier to try to dive headfirst in your core business process and to try to apply AI to it. But a problem-first approach, and then like what are the new tools we have that we didn't have 5-10 years ago? I've always felt that that was something that Steve Jobs was truly great at, meaning like he understood what humans were trying to do, which is like communicate and improve. Like just the analogy he always used to have, computer is a bicycle for the mind, just blows me away, like some of those things. How do you see about if someone's going to go into their core business process, how do you start there and how do you diffuse the risk?
Yeah. Well, first of all, is you sit down with an organization and you say, what frictions do you have? What pain points do you have? Mm-hmm. And most organizations, if you spend a day with them, they list between 50 and 500. Right. And then, you know, you need to then ask yourself, well, what are the right approaches to solving this problem? Don't just default to generative AI, mm-hmm. because generative AI might only solve a fraction of it. It might be optimization or task automation or machine learning. And then I have a very, very simple framework to prioritize those frictions. First of all, mm-hmm. is the data there to help me solve the problem? If it's not, then it's probably going to be quite costly to ready the data. The second one, obviously, what's my return on investment or estimated return on investment? How quickly will I get my return on investment? Do I have stakeholder alignment? And do I have the team internally to help make sure that this is delivered on? Is it hypeable? There's a few criteria that I use. Mm-hmm. And then what you need to do is you then need to start knocking them off one by one. Do you buy something? Do you build it yourself? Because it's a differentiation. But you make sure then you build your AI capability over time rather than starting with a data lake and hoping that that's going to solve all your problems. But you start out by listing your frictions, getting hopefully an expert in, and not somebody that's rebranded themselves as an expert, to help really understand what it will take to solve those frictions.
That's super interesting. And I love your red flags, and I love your sort of organizational readiness and how to identify the types of problems that are ready to solve. Amazon famously has a list of questions it asks itself if it's going to start a new business, like, do we have differentiated value? Do we have the talent in-house, or can we acquire it quickly? You know, is this going to move the needle? These are like simple questions people can apply. And so I really appreciate you sharing those.
And I know it's obvious, but the reality is that we get very excited about emerging technologies and, you know, we get told that we need to go and deploy them by consultants. And the reality is even if you haven't started on your AI journey yet, you might not be behind because a lot of people have started and they've been investing in the wrong things.
I want to move on to the next myth, which is pervasive. Even though some people know it's not true, it is certainly true in some sense. AI will destroy jobs. Is this sort of like near and dear to your heart, myth?
It is. There's a term which is called the economic singularity. It was coined by a very good friend called Callum Chase. I'd highly recommend his books. Mm-hmm. It's something I've been thinking about a lot. You know, for the past 18 years, I've been building AI solutions that have been freeing people from tasks. They've not lost their job. They've gone on to do more important, impactful things within their organizations. I think that at least for the next 5 years, we're going to see a Cambrian explosion of new innovations, and there'll be more ways for humanity to be able to contribute. And if I'm honest with you, beyond 5 years, nobody knows what they're talking about. Even the two extremes of the argument. The one extreme of the argument is that, look, the capitalistic model to reduce costs, increase profits, means that when AI can free up whole jobs, it probably will. We'll stop hiring, we'll remove people from those roles. If that happens very quickly, then what will happen is that if it happens lots, then our economies won't be able to rebalance fast enough, and it could lead to social unrest. And I actually think that we need to lean into that problem. Whether it be UBI, 4-day working week, we need some mechanisms to take the edge off mass technological deployment. The counter example to this, or the counter argument, is that by removing friction, which usually means human labor, from the creation and dissemination of goods, you can bring the cost of those goods down so much that they become free. So imagine being born into a world where your food, your healthcare, your education, your transport, your energy is all free. It's all abundant. I'm not talking about taxing rich people and giving it to poor people. I'm talking about bringing the cost of goods down so much that they become free. People often say to me, you know, what would I do in that world? Right? Job defines who I'm as a human. I know a lot of people who've become economically free. Most of them are not sitting at home bored and depressed. A lot of them trying to figure out how to use their wares to contribute somehow to humanity. And I ask people this question all the time. What would you do if you were economically free and everything was abundant? They'll say, you know, I'll play golf and travel and indulge in my hobbies and spend time with my friends and family. If you keep pushing people hard enough, they say the same thing, which is they want to make the world a bit better. And one of the promises of AI is actually to free people from those economic constraints to allow them to, what I would argue is to live their true humanity, which is not just living for themselves, but for living for other humans. There will always be work. There will always be scarcity.
Yeah.
There will always be people that you love that don't love you back. There will always be things that you want that you can't have. If we all had a helicopter, we'd be arguing who leaves first. Like, space and time is scarce. But there are unfortunately too many people falling into this world into economic constraints, and we need to solve that problem.
I think it's interesting. There are a lot of roles that are being redefined and not replaced. Clearly, you know, not necessarily just LLMs, but AI and robotics and the kind of like just whole industrial automation has been replacing human jobs for years, yet there's still plenty of human jobs in warehouses. What are other types of roles that are sort of being redefined and not replaced?
Well, I mean, if you look back when the internet started, we didn't have SEO experts and, you know, influencers and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, a whole load of jobs were created to leverage this new capability, which is the internet. And I think the same thing's going to happen. We're actually, lots of jobs will be created over the next several years that we haven't imagined. The problem with this type of technology is never before have we had a technology that can do things that humans can do. They can actually do the labor that human can do. And so I think this is why this industrial revolution is a little bit different. And we need to be walking into it with our eyes wide open.
And speaking of walking into it with our eyes wide open, one group of people that tends to walk around with their eyes shut, bumping into things is politicians. So like, if we're going to talk about government for a second, is there a policy or mindset shift that policymakers need to adopt that they're not thinking about today?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the politicians I engage with, it feels like they understand these things. They understand the implications. But a little bit like, you know, if you're the CEO of a FTSE company, you're in some respects at the whim of the market. You need to deliver quarterly reports, annual reports. Same for politicians, right? They need to make sure that they're voted in 4 years' time. So I don't know. I think ultimately politicians need to create the right fertile ground for enterprise to come up with innovations that solve a lot of the challenges that we face. They need to put regulation in place to mitigate the risk, but I think they need to not interfere. They need to get out of the way of innovation, but obviously ensure that people are innovating safely. And actually, I'm a believer that actually enterprise is going to make the world better. If you think about the purpose of most companies, if AI was to help companies actually achieve their purpose and actually arguably hold companies account to achieving their purpose, AI agents that are going to be buying from those companies will actually be going to be much more rational about buying from those, and they're going to hold them to account. And if we hold companies account to achieving their purpose and we help companies achieve their purpose, it's that collective purpose of enterprise that actually make this world of abundance.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting because people need to plan for what they're going to do. They need to understand how they can apply their time. Politicians need to think about whole groups of people can access economic opportunities if they've been, you know, denied them. What are young people going to do? There's a lot of worries about young people coming into the workforce. How do you, if you don't have lower level jobs, how do you get higher level jobs? And I think that's a real concern.
It is. You know, and again, the aspiration is that those people that have some economic freedom, some resources, will hopefully come up with ideas to help solve that problem. And arguably, AI can help educate people more quickly. Arguably, AI platforms can help connect people that are isolated in society. So, the more that we free people from those economic constraints, the more that we enable them to use these technologies to actually help contribute positively to society.
I wanted to have a last question a little bit about commerce, because obviously we're hugely focused on commerce here. How do you mentioned AI and agents being buyers. What are some of the other implications of the AI revolution on commerce that you're seeing beyond a sort of agentic buying?
Oh yeah, so you know, GEO, GSO, so generative search optimization. So look, if I say to you, what brand do you think about if I say safe cars? Uh-huh. Most people will say Volvo or something. And if I say extreme sports, probably Red Bull. And if I say Christmas, some people might say Coca-Cola or John Lewis or whatever.
Yeah.
What I'm doing is I'm activating neurons in your brain. I'm asking you to report on what other neurons are being activated. In some respects, the reason why those neurons are correlated in your brain is because you've been given content that associated those values with those brands. Advertising. Mm-hmm. With advertising has reinforced those concepts. Same for large language models. Large language models are trained on this corpus of the internet, and it associates these concepts in its brain. So when you go and say to Gemini, tell me what cars are safe. How do I make sure that Volvo, Tesla, whoever appear in the results? And what content do I need to put on the internet to make sure that my brand, my products are associated with those, essentially those requests? That's an interesting new opportunity for us to solve for.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is super interesting. There are lots of new problems to solve. How do we communicate our brand ethos and values through, you know, these new interfaces that we're not fully in control over? But again, we've never really were. And as soon as you put your message in the world, you're giving it to your customers, you're giving it to the market, and you never know what the market is going to do with it.
No, exactly. I mean, part of that is about reputation management, PR, but back in the day, you used to be able to game the Google algorithm. You could put white words on a white background and it would then pick your website up over this. Now, of course, you can't. I think there are 400 different parameters that Google considers when matching searches with content. Same for large language models. They're going to get smarter over time.
Yeah.
And rather than just putting loads of content on Reddit, which is probably where they get trained most of the time, the key idea is making sure that your content is in the right place, relevant for that customer. And the models will pick that up.
Yeah, no, I mean, this has been so fascinating. I really appreciate this sort of myth-busting approach to AI. I personally learned a ton from this. I love how you frame this, that this is not an apocalypse. You know, everyone's not going to lose their jobs. We're still going to continue, but it's an evolution. And I think the takeaway for a lot of SaaS and e-commerce leaders is like, don't just go for the edges. Go for your core business problem. Don't fear the technology. It's actually, frankly, riskier standing still. And then finally, like, build your values into the solutions you want to see in the world and like keep pushing forward. So do you have any last words for our listeners?
No, I'm happy to always engage, keep the conversation going. You can reach me on LinkedIn or email.
Thanks so much again, Daniel. And
thanks,
great for you to spend time today.